Today I'm going to talk about the relation of photography to a condition in the arts that for most people is either confusing or irritating, or both. That is postmodernism. What I'm going to try and do, God willing, is to explain something about what postmodernism is, to explain how it relates to and challenges the photographic tradition as Beaumont Newhall has so conscientiously and faithfully written it, and to examine why the ideas and practices of postmodernist art are so unsettling to our traditional ways of thinking. If I could have the first slide. Perfect. Do I have to? Let me try. Oh, I have the buttons under my control. Great. I can almost see it. What is postmodernism? Is it a method, like the practice of using images that already exist? Is it an attitude, like irony? Is it a theory, like Marxism? Or is it a plot conjured up by a cabal of New York dealers and critics, designed to upset our elders and overturn the art world establishment, making lots of money and fame for everyone involved? These are all answers that I've heard, and I suppose they all have some nugget of truth somewhere. But for better or worse, the concept of postmodernism is a bit more complicated than this. One complication in arriving at any definition of postmodernism as it manifests itself in the arts is that it means different things in different artistic media. It was apparently first used in architecture as a way of describing a turn away from the hermetically sealed glass boxes and walled concrete bunkers of modern architecture. In coming up with the term postmodern, architects had a very specific and clearly defined target in mind: the less is more reductivism of Mies van der Rohe and his disciples. The slide you're seeing is a picture of a modernist building designed by I.M. Pei in 1968, a building that resembles a fortress or bunker, but which in fact is the Everson Art Museum in Syracuse. So at first, postmodernism in architecture meant eclecticism, that is, the use of stylistic flourishes and decorative ornament with a kind of carefree slapdash and ultimately value-free abandon. Here we see Charles Moore's Piazza d'Italia in New Orleans, a classic example of postmodernist architecture's urge to combine old and new styles with an almost hedonistic intensity. Freed of the rigors of Miesian design, architects felt at liberty to reintroduce precisely those elements of architectural syntax that Mies had purged from the vocabulary, that is, historical allusion, metaphor, jokey allusionism, spatial ambiguity. What the English architectural critic Charles Jenks says of Michael Graves' New Portland building in the book The Language of Postmodern Architecture is true of postmodern architecture as a whole. Quote, "It is evidently an architecture of inclusion which takes the multiplicity of differing demands seriously: ornament, color, representational sculpture, urban morphology, and more purely architectural demands such as structure, space, and light." If architecture's postmodernism is involved with redecorating the stripped-down elements of architectural modernism, with restoring some of the emotional complexity and spiritual capacity that the best buildings seem to have, the postmodernism of dance is something else entirely. Modern dance, as we have come to know it, consists of a tradition extending from Loie Fuller through Martha Graham. As anyone who has seen Miss Graham's dances can attest, emotional and spiritual expressionism are the hallmarks of modern dance. Postmodern dance, which dates from the experimental work of the Judson Dance Theater in New York in the early 60s, was and is an attempt to throw off the heroicism and expressionism of modernist dance by making dance more vernacular. The Judson Theater troupe, whose dancers included Tricia Brown, Lucinda Childs, Steve Paxton, and Yvonne Rainer, based dances on everyday gestures such as walking and turning, often enlisting the audience or using untrained walk-ons as dancers. This picture shows an improvisation by a group called the Grand Union Dance Company, a successor to the Judson Theater, which was done in New York in 1971 for the benefit of the Black Panthers. Postmodern dance eliminated narrative, reduced decoration, and purged illusions. In other words, it was and is not far removed from what we call modern in architecture. Now, what's interesting is that more recently, this idea of postmodernist dance has been replaced in vanguard circles in New York by an as yet unnamed style that seeks to re-inject elements of biography, narrative, and political issues into the structure of the dance, using illusion and decoration and difficult dance steps in the process. It is, in its own way, exactly what postmodern architecture is, and like it, it attempts to revitalize the art form through inclusion rather than exclusion. But the point I want to make is that the term postmodernism is used to mean something very different in dance than it is in architecture. The same condition exists in music and in literature. Each defines its postmodernism in relation to its own peculiar modernism. To edge perhaps a bit closer to the situation today in photography, let us consider postmodernism as it is constituted in today's art world, which is to say within the tradition and practice of those, quote, high, unquote, visual media of painting and sculpture. What modernism is in this tradition is a vastly complicated subject, but what I can try to make clear is how modernism in the visual arts has been defined by postmodernist thought. For a while there in the 1970s, it was possible to think of postmodernism as equivalent to pluralism, a catchword that was the art world's equivalent of Tom Wolfe's phrase, the me decade. According to the pluralists, the tradition of modernism from Cézanne to Kenneth Nolan had plumb tuckered out, that through its own assumptions run itself into the ground. Painting was finished, and all that was left to do was either minimalism, which no one much liked to look at, or conceptualism, which no one could look at, its goal being to avoid producing another art object. Decoration and representation were out, eye appeal was suspect, emotional appeal thought sloppy, if not gauche. This is a Donald Judd sculpture from 1967, spare geometry based on mathematical models, and it might be said to represent late modernism at its most reductive and recondite. Facing this exhaustion, the artists of the 70s went off in 100 directions at once, at least according to the pluralist model. Some started painting frankly decorative pattern paintings. Some made sculpture from the earth or from abandoned buildings. Some started using photography and video, mixing media and adding to the pluralist stew. One consequence of the opening of the modernist gates was that photography, that seemingly perennial second-class citizen, became a naturalized member of the gallery and museum circuit. But my main point is that modernism's reductionism, or to be somewhat more fair about it, what was seen as modernism's reductionism, was countered with a flood of new practices, some of them clearly anti-modernist. But was this pluralism truly an attack on the underlying assumptions of modernism, as modernism was perceived in the mid to late 1970s? Or was it, as Douglas Crimp has put it, one of, quote, the morbid symptoms of modernism's demise? According to critics of Mr. Crimp's persuasion, which is to say of the persuasion of October magazine, postmodernism in the art world means something more than simply what comes after modernism. It means, for them, an attack on modernism, an undercutting of its basic assumptions about the role of art in the culture and about the role of the artist in relation to his or her art. This undercutting function frequently goes by the name deconstruction, a word for which the French theoretician Jacques Derrida is responsible. Behind it lies a theory about the way we perceive the world that is known as structuralism. So it would help us to know something about the theory of structuralism, which has its roots in the beginning of the 20th century. There it is. Structuralism is a theory of language, and it is based on the work of the Swiss linguist Ferdinand de Saussure in Course in General Linguistics from 1916. It is allied with, if not inseparable from, the theory of semiotics or signs pioneered by the American philosopher C.S. Pierce about the same time. Now, what structuralist linguistic theory and semiotic sign theory have in common is the belief that things in the world, literary texts, images, what have you, do not wear their meanings on their sleeves. They must be deciphered or decoded in order to be understood. In other words, things have a deeper structure than common sense would permit us to comprehend, and structuralism provides a method that purports to allow us to penetrate that deeper structure. Basically, and I'm being very basic here, its method is to divide everything in two. It takes the sign, a word, say, in language, or an image, or even a pair of women's shoes, and divides it in two, into the signifier, which is an arbitrarily assigned pointer or listing device, and the signified, which is the referent that the signifier points to. It might help to think of the example of Morse code, the dots and dashes being the signifiers and the letters they represent being the signifieds. Together, they constitute the sign. But according to semioticians, the sign-building process doesn't stop there. It is an endless chain without a beginning or an end. Thus, in the example here, the sign SOS also constitutes a signifier whose signified is the urgent appeal, help. Now, this seems pretty reasonable, if not exactly simple. But structuralism also holds that the signifier is wholly arbitrary, a convention of social practice rather than universal law. Therefore, structuralism in practice sets aside the ultimate meaning or signified part of the sign and concentrates on the relations of the signifiers within any given work. In a sense, it holds that the obvious meaning is irrelevant. Instead, it finds its territory within the structure of things, hence the name structuralism. Some of the consequences of this approach are detailed in Terry Eagleton's recent book, Literary Theory and Introduction. Quote, first, it does not matter to structuralism that a story is hardly an example of great literature. The method is quite indifferent to the cultural value of its object. Second, structuralism is a calculated affront to common sense. It does not take the text at face value, but displaces it into a quite different kind of object. Third, if the particular contents of the text are replaceable, there is a sense in which one can say that the content of the narrative is its structure. It might help us to think about structuralism in the same way that we think about sociology, in the sense that it is a pseudoscience. What it does, in other words, is attempt to find a rationalist scientific basis for describing human activities, social behavior in sociology's case, language and image making in the case of structuralism and semiotics. It is a symptom of a certain historical desire to make the realm of human creativity a bit more neat and a bit more calculable. It fits into another historical process as well, which is the gradual replacement of our faith in the obvious with an equally compelling faith in what is not obvious, in what can be uncovered or discovered through analysis. We might date this trend to Copernicus, who had the audacity to claim that the Earth revolved around the Sun, even though it is obvious to all of us that the Sun revolves around the Earth and does so once a day. To quote Terry Eagleton again, Copernicus was followed by Marx, who claimed that the true significance of social processes went on behind the backs of individual agents. And after Marx, Freud argued that the real meaning of our words and actions were quite imperceptible to the conscious mind. Structuralism is the modern inheritor of this belief that reality and our experience of it are discontinuous with each other. Close quote. Post-structuralism under Derrida goes a step further, where classical structuralism at least believed in the fixedness of the part of the sign called a signifier. Under post-structuralism, even the signifiers and their interrelations are held to be slippery and arbitrary. We can see something of this gap in this picture by Les Levine, a New York artist, which rips the word move, which functions at once as a noun and a verb, from its customary moorings. According to the post-structuralists, our perceptions only tell us about what our perceptions are, not about the true conditions of the world. There's no way to arrive at the ultimate meaning of anything. Meaning is always withheld, and to believe the opposite is tantamount to mythology. As Eagleton says, paraphrasing Derrida, nothing is ever fully present in signs. It is an illusion for me to believe that I can ever be fully present to you in what I say or write, because to use signs at all entails that my meaning is always somehow dispersed, divided, and never quite at one with itself. Not only my meaning, indeed, but me. Since language is something I am made out of, rather than merely a convenient tool that I use, the whole idea that I am a stable, unified entity must also be a fiction. It is not that I can have a pure, unblemished meaning, intention, or experience, which then gets distorted and refracted by the flawed medium of language. Because language is the very air that I breathe, I can never have a pure, unblemished meaning or experience at all. Close quote. This inability to have a pure, unblemished meaning or experience at all is, I would submit, exactly the premise of the art we call postmodernist. And I would venture to argue, it is the theme which characterizes a great majority of contemporary photography, explicitly or implicitly. Calling it a theme is perhaps too bland. It is the crisis which photography and all other forms of art as well face in the late 20th century. So now we know something about postmodernism in terms of how it is theoretically conceived in the arts, and how it looks, but how does it look visually? Under what guise are we to recognize the postmodern in pictures? If we return to the initial conception of postmodernism in the art world, namely the notion of pluralism, we can say quite blithely that postmodernist art is art that looks like anything except modernist art. In fact, we could even stretch things a bit and say that postmodernist art could even incorporate the modernist look. But this pinpoints exactly why no one has ever been satisfied with pluralism as a concept. It may well describe the absence of a single prevailing style, but it does not describe the presence of anything. Obviously, a critical concept that embraces everything imaginable is not much use to anyone. The critical theory based on structuralism has a much better chance of defining what postmodernist visual art should look like, but even here there's quite a bit of latitude. Obviously, most postmodernist critics of this ideological bent insist that postmodernist art be oppositional. This opposition can be conceived of in two ways, as counter to the modernist tradition and as counter to the ruling mythologies of Western culture. These same critics tend to agree that postmodernist art, therefore, must debunk or deconstruct the, quote, myths, unquote, of the individual, which is what is called the myth of the author, and of the individual subject, which is what is called the myth of originality. But when we get to the level of how these aims are best accomplished, that is, what style of art might achieve these ends, we find a bit of disagreement and, simultaneously, ambiguity. One concept of postmodernist style is that it should consist of a mixture of media, thereby dispelling modernism's fetishistic concentration on the medium as a message, painting about painting, photography about photography, and so on. For example, one could make theatrical paintings or filmic photographs or combine pictures with the written word. That would all be postmodernist. A corollary to this suggests that the use of so-called alternative media, anything other than painting on canvas and sculpture in metal, is a hallmark of the postmodern. This is a view that actually lifts photography up from its traditional second-class status and privileges it as the medium of the moment. And there is yet another view that holds that the medium doesn't matter at all. All that matters is the way in which art operates within and against the culture. As the critic Rosalind Krauss has written, quote, within the situation of postmodernism, practice is not defined in relation to a given medium, for example, sculpture, but rather in relation to the logical operations on a set of cultural terms for which any medium, photography, books, lines on walls, mirrors, or sculpture itself might be used. Close quote. Stylistically, if we might entertain the notion of style in terms of postmodernist art, certain practices have been advanced as essentially postmodernist. Foremost among these is the concept of pastiche, of assembling one's art from a variety of sources. This is not quite done as a way of honoring one's artistic heritage, but is not quite the same as parody either. As Frederick Jameson explains it in an essay called Postmodernism and Consumer Society, quote, pastiche is, like parody, the imitation of a particular or unique style, the wearing of a stylistic mask, speech in a dead language. But it is a neutral practice of such mimicry, without parody's ulterior motive, without the satirical motive, without laughter, without the still latent feeling that there exists something normal compared to which that what is being imitated is rather comic. Pastiche is blank parody, parody that has lost its sense of humor. Now, pastiche can take many forms. It doesn't necessarily mean, for example, that one must collage one's sources together, as often happens in the case of postmodernist architecture, or as Robert Rauschenberg has done, having been cited as a kind of postmodernist for his combine paintings of the 1950s and his photo collages of the early 1960s. This is Rauschenberg's 1954 painting, Bantam, which obviously incorporates photographic and other sorts of imagery. Let us consider another sort of work, a 1982 painting by Walter Robinson titled Revenge. Now, the first thing to be said about this painting is that it looks like something out of a romance magazine, not something in the tradition of Picasso or Rothko. It takes as its subject a rather debased, stereotypical view of the negligee-clad femme fatale and paints her in a rather debased, illustrative manner. We might say that it adopts the tawdry, male-dominated discourse of female sexuality as found at the lower depths of the mass media. It wears that discourse as a mask. It wears this mask not to poke fun at it, nor to flatter it by imitation, nor to point us in the direction of something more genuine that lies behind it. It wears this mask in order to unmask it, to point to its internal inconsistencies, its inadequacies, its failures, its stereotypical unreality. Here is another example, a 1981 painting by Thomas Lawson called Battered to Death. Now, nothing in this painting, with its blandly quizzical child depicted in almost photorealist style, prepares us in the least for the title Battered to Death, which is very much to the point. The artist has used as his source for the portrait a newspaper photograph which bore the unhappy headline that is the painting's title. The painting wears the mask of banality, but that mask is broken by the title, shifted onto a whole other level of meaning, just as it was when it appeared in the newspaper. So this painting tells us something about the ways in which newspapers alter or manipulate objectivity, and it speaks to the separation between style and meaning, image and text, object and intention. In the act of donning a mask, it unmasks, or in Derrida's terminology, it deconstructs. There is, it goes without saying, a certain self-consciousness to paintings like these, but it is not a self-consciousness that promotes an identification with the artist, as is traditionally the case. Think, for instance, of Velázquez's presence in Las Meninas. Rather, as this painting by Mark Tansey makes explicit, this is called Homage to Susan Sontag, it is a self-consciousness that promotes an awareness of photographic representation, of the camera's role in creating and disseminating the, quote, commodities, unquote, of visual culture. Let us now turn to a photograph, an 8x10-inch black and white image by Cindy Sherman from the series Untitled Film Stills. Here again, a kind of debased form of imagery is the model that the artist chooses to don as a mask. And in the process, she unmasks the conventions not only of film noir, but of woman as depicted object. The stilted submissiveness of her subject refers to questions of feminine identity and, in a larger way, questions the whole idea of personal identity, male or female. Since she uses herself as her subject in all her photographs, we might want to call these self-portraits, but in essence, they deny the self. It has been pointed out by a number of observers that Sherman's imagery borrows heavily from the almost subliminal image universe of film, television, fashion photography, and advertising. One can see, for instance, certain similarities between her 1981 photograph of a woman beside the telephone with this publicity still from the 1962 movie Experiment in Terror, clipped from the New York Times. But her pictures are not so much specific borrowings from the past as they are distillations of cultural types. Neither are the masks Miss Sherman creates merely parodies of cultural roles in the manner of photographer Judy Dater's latest work, nor are they layers like the skin of an onion which, peeled back, might reveal some inner essence. Hers are perfectly post-structuralist portraits, for they admit to the ultimate unknowableness of the eye. That is, they challenge the essential assumption of the discrete, identifiable, recognizable author. We can see another kind of masking in the pictures by Eileen Cowan called family docudramas. Modeled loosely on soap opera tableau, film stills, or the sort of scenes one finds in a European photo roman, these rather elegant color photographs depict arranged family situations in which a sense of discord and anxiety prevails. Like Sherman, Cowan uses herself as the foil of the piece, and she goes further, including her own family and, at times, her identical twin sister. The pictures that show us both twins at once seem to me particularly evocative inasmuch as we read the two women as one, as participant and as observer, as reality and as fantasy, as anxious ego and as critical superego. In Cowan's work, what is unmasked is not just the conventions of familial self-depiction. One can note how distant her pictures are from family snapshots, for example, but also our conventional ways of interpersonal behavior and the disparity between how we like to think we behave and how others see us behaving. Laurie Simmons's photographs are as carefully staged, as fabricated, as directorial as those of Cindy Sherman and Eileen Cowan, but she usually makes use of miniaturized representations of human beings in equally miniaturized environments. In her early dollhouse images, female figures grapple somewhat uncertainly with the accoutrements of everyday middle-class life, cleaning bathrooms, confronting dirty kitchen tables, bending over large lipstick containers. Simmons clearly uses the doll figures as stand-ins for her parents, for herself, for cultural models as she remembers them from the 1960s as a child growing up in the suburbs. She's simultaneously interested in examining the conventions of behavior she acquired in her childhood and in exposing the conventions of representation that were the means by which these behavior patterns were transmitted. As is true also of the work of Ellen Brooks, the dollhouse functions as a reminder of lost innocence. Simmons' more recent work has an eerie, spacey look that is suggestive of 1950s and 1960s science fiction. The figures here take on a stiff and stilted clone-like quality, like the townspeople in the film The Invasion of the Body Snatchers or the replicants in Blade Runner. Now, so far I've been discussing work that functions by creating surrogates, the masking half of the masking-unmasking dyad being emphasized. But let us turn our attention to some work that emphasizes unmasking, such as this 1979 untitled photograph by Richard Prince. Do not feel victimized if this picture looks to you like a print advertisement greatly enlarged, for that is exactly what it is. Prince is the leading practitioner of the art of re-photography. What he does is to photograph pictures that he finds in magazines, cropping them as he sees fit, with the aim of unmasking the syntax of the advertising photography language. His art also implies the exhaustion of the image universe. It suggests that a photographer can find more than enough images already existing in the world without the bother of having to make new ones. Pressed on this point, Prince will admit that he has no desire to create images from the raw material of the physical world. He's perfectly content, happy actually, to glean his material from photographic reproductions. Prince is also a writer of considerable talent, so perhaps I should let him explain his views in his own words. I want to read to you two passages from his recent book, Why I Go to the Movies Alone, in hopes that they will illuminate not only his attitudes toward the world, but also the attitudes of many artists of this postmodern era. The characters you will meet in the quotes are called he or they, but you might just as well see them as stand-ins for the artists, for the artist as his own verbal masks. Quote, magazines, movies, TV, and records. It wasn't everybody's condition, but to him it sometimes seemed like it was. And if it really wasn't, that was all right.